was really quick. I'm Laura, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Laura.
All right, so I'm nervous. And when I get nervous, my chest gets red, so don't be alarmed if that starts happening. So I have a sobriety date that's June 4th, 2009. I have a sponsor that's taken me through the 12 steps, and I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other women in this program. I have a home group. It's Bonner Big Book. It meets on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. in Bonner. It's near Richmond. So if you're ever in the area, please come by. We'd love to have you. That pretty much gets all the formal stuff out of the way. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I'm going to do the best I can to stay on track. I don't have a problem with honesty when telling my story because my story never changes, but sometimes I get a little sidetracked on something and have to come rein it back in. So, all right, so I usually give a little bit of background about myself. So I was born and raised in a little suburb, like 25 miles north of Baltimore City. And I was part of a relatively large family, had two brothers and a sister. And my parents are very loving parents, still are. I was going to say they were. They are an alcoholic. I believe that there might be a genetic component, but, I mean, as far as I go, it's in my extended family. For me, my general belief is that I was born with spiritual malady. I wasn't necessarily born an alcoholic, because I wasn't born with the bottle, but a malady started manifesting itself probably around the age of, I'd say, 8 or 9. I was in the 3rd or 4th grade, and I started feeling really uncomfortable in my own skin. I mean, I could be in a room with 25 people, feel like I was the only one there, or that everybody there was talking about me, you know, because it was always all about me. From an early age, I defied my parents. You know, I would do things that they told me not to do. I was always a rebel. When I was 3 years old, you know, my mom told me not to climb up on a stool in the kitchen. I climbed up and it broke my arm. You know, I don't think that I was afflicted with this at 3 years old, but, I mean, the pattern started then. And, you know, all throughout my childhood, my parents were trying to fix the Laura problem. You know, like, what can we do, you know, to help her? You know, what kind of therapy can we put her in? I had a lot of anger as a kid, and for no reason. My parents thought it was something that they were doing. They absolutely did a good job, and they did the best that they could. You know, I didn't have a bad childhood. My parents didn't abuse me in any way. You know, it was just the way I was. That's the way I was wired. And, you know, I remember being in therapy as early as 4 years old, and you know, it was painful for me because they tried me out on all these medications and things like that. And, you know, I went to social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists. Things seemed to work for a short time and then they wouldn't work anymore. And the anger just kept growing as I got older. And, one of the ways that I dealt with that as a child, like in late elementary school and middle school age, was that, you know, I was kind of a tomboy. And so to prove myself, and this sounds ridiculous, but to prove myself, I would go beat up every boy in the neighborhood. And that was a good outlet for me, too. But I realized, because I kept getting in trouble, that wasn't the right type of behavior to live by. And, you know, my parents would constantly try to ground me, and what would happen when that would happen is that I'd run away. You know, I'd be gone for a couple days. I had a friend whose parents weren't as stern as my parents, and kind of drank a lot, and so really they really didn't know what was going on, so I'd run to her house and stay there. So that's kind of the stuff I was doing from an early age. And then I became an arsonist. I lit the woods near my house on fire. I really like fire. You know, and that's just kind of the way that this started for me. So, you know, fast forward to, I guess, the age of 11 or 12, this friend who I had, whose mother and father were kind of, you know, they drank a lot. I would go over there and we would see cigarettes laying around all over the house, because they smoked in the house. And so we thought, oh, let's take some cigarettes, see what that's like. And of course, we didn't inhale them or anything like that, but we'd go to the nearby high school yard and just smoke cigarettes. And that turned into, we saw how her parents drink, we started to see other kids drinking, and that turned into, you know, me and the handful of friends I had saying that that sounded like a good idea to us, that that's something we wanted to pursue. And I noticed that my parents had a fully stocked liquor cabinet, because my parents don't drink. They'd get bottles from people as gifts, and they'd just put them in this liquor cabinet, and they'd sit there. So I noticed this. I don't know why I noticed this, but I noticed this, and I told my friends, I said, you know, I have easy access to this stuff. It's not locked. So I'm gonna go steal some from the parents. And so that's what I did. I stole, I believe it was Captain Morgan's Spice Rum. And I have never liked rum, ever. But that's like the first thing I ever drank. I stole that. I stole Cream de Menthe. Oh, that was horrible, horrible tasting. But we took those two bottles and we went to the woods that I burned down. And and we were sitting there on a log, and I just remember I told her to take the first sip, and she took a sip and just promptly vomited. And she was like, I'm done, and handed the bottle to me, and I took a sip, and I was like, well, this is all right, you know, like, I guess I'll, you know, have another sip. And so I took a few sips. Nothing really magical happened that day, but I wanted to do it again because I feel like I didn't get the full experience. So the following weekend, because this was just weekends at the time since we were so young, none of us drove or anything like that, there was this 44-year-old man that lived nearby. He was most likely an alcoholic. No, we're not supposed to say that about other people, but he also had no money. So he said that if we asked him to buy us booze, and he said that if he bought us booze, every time he bought us booze, he would like us to buy him a 40-ounce. He said, that's fine. So he started buying us booze pretty regularly, but the first time he did, I purchased 3 40-ounces, and I drank all of them. And this is the second time I drank, and of course I vomited. I passed out. I blacked out. I did all of that, all of those things. I was 12 or 13 years old. I remember I passed out in front of a fire hydrant in my neighborhood, in front of my friend's house. I mean, I was probably safe. It was fine. But my parents gave me a curfew, and I came home an hour early, which is not like me at all. I mean, if anything, I'm coming in late and sneaking out later. Like, that's how things worked. But that happened, and I felt what most alcoholics describe was that warm feeling, that sensation where I didn't get taller. Some people describe getting taller or smarter or prettier or all those things. None of those things happened, but I didn't care anymore about what anybody thought. My mind had always been racing a mile a minute. You know, since the early age of, you know, 8 or 9, my mind was always just always going. There was this committee up there that just wouldn't shut up. And this quieted that. And I was like, this is great. I'm going to pursue this whenever I can. So that's exactly what happened. I just kept, you know, whenever I could, stealing booze from my parents, stealing booze from my friend's parents, you know, getting Billy, his name was Billy, to buy us booze, you know. And that evolved into me drinking more often, and that also evolved into me starting to experiment with other things that I don't get into out of respect for AA, but drugs are a very large part of my story. Pretty much anything that got me out of myself, I wanted, you know, because I didn't like myself for whatever reason. I just never did, except for when I was drinking, and I just didn't care, you know. So I go into high school. I wasn't popular at all in middle school. I had, like, no friends. I was very withdrawn, very angry, pretty much seething. No one wanted to come near me. So that eighth grade year of middle school, going into ninth grade high school, that's when I started drinking. And since I didn't care anymore, I made all these friends in high school. Everybody seemed to like me because I just didn't, you know, nothing affected me. And that only lasted for about 2 years. Until this thing put its claws in me and grabbed hold of me. You know, I was a good student in high school. I was a good athlete. I was a pretty damn good tennis player. And I thought, and my parents thought, that if I, you know, kept playing tennis the way I was playing and just practiced really hard, that I probably could get a scholarship in college. But the alcohol started coming before anything else, you know, and I went downhill pretty quickly because not only because of the alcohol, but because of everything else I was doing. But I was a really nasty, belligerent drunk, and that started happening when I was pretty much drinking daily. I don't know when I crossed that magical line of becoming an alcoholic, but I do know that it was sometime in my, you know, primitive early years, and I kept going with it. I got cut from the tennis team my 12th grade year because I didn't practice, because I was skipping school a lot, and I just didn't care anymore about things like that. The one thing I did still care about was college, and in my family, you go to college, and I told my parents to save the money, I'd go to community college. So I graduated from high school, and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go up the street. I'm going to live with my parents. It'll be great. I don't have to pay rent. I don't have to do anything, you know. I'll just feed off them and go to classes every now and then. And it worked out. The only thing is, right when I graduated from high school, I had my first legal consequence. I was hanging out with this girl that I had ran with for many years since we started doing that stuff. And I was over her. She had an apartment. I was over there, and I was driving home 3 o'clock in the morning, and I got pulled over at a sobriety checkpoint. It was random, and I got a DUI. And the police were very nice to me. At that point, I wasn't too belligerent yet. I didn't cuss them out or anything. That would come later. But, you know, I was upset. I was like, young, I was 17 or 18 years old, and, you know, I'm getting handcuffed and taken wherever they're taking me, and they, you know, said, we're not going to impound your car, your parents can come get your car, we're not going to keep you in jail tonight, they can come get you, we're just going to do your paperwork and you can go. So that happened, went to court for that, got probation for 3 years, you know, had to put an interlock device on my car, you know, blow every time I drove, and all that stuff. But I'm like, yeah, everybody's doing what I'm doing. I'm 17, 18 years old. This is just a fluke. You know, it's not a big deal. Well, it wasn't at the time. But I, you know, they sentenced me to AA meetings. That was a stipulation of my probation and intensive outpatient therapy, rehab. And so I had to go to 3 AA meetings a week. And I'll tell you something, nothing sunk in then because I wasn't ready to hear it. I would sit in these meetings. I'd be the last one to come in, and I'd be the first one to leave because I just wanted to go drink. That's all I wanted to do. And college was still important to me, and it turned out that it would remain important to me because, for me, I had no self-worth. As I said earlier, I did not like myself. So that was a way for me to define myself. If I had this degree, I was worth something. And so I worked really hard at it. And I started tapering off the booze in college because I figured out really early on that I couldn't write a paper drunk. It just didn't work. The room would spin. It was just not good. So I started moving on to those other substances just for that time. And, you know, I got through school. During school, I picked up a hostage, and we dated for about between 4 and 5 years, something like that. But anyway, this poor individual would do anything and everything for me. You know, he was my babysitter, my chauffeur, my banker, my mom, my dad. I mean, he basically was my caregiver. And I treated him like absolute garbage. So I decided, you know, I was working at this outfitter all through college, you know, like a mom, pa, smaller than REI, but, you know, it was a really fun job for me, and they promoted me to manager, and I was like, this is great, you know, I've arrived, because I'm making way more money than anyone my age, you know, so, I start stealing from them, of course, because I like to steal and manipulate. That's anything that would benefit me, I would do. And I didn't care who I walked all over. It didn't matter. My parents started to notice things around this time, too. My drinking was escalating. I was angry again. It was still a good solution for me in terms of my mind and my mind not going a mile a minute. I call it the circus, you know, and I can have varying degrees of the circus in my head. So they might be setting up like one tent, or they could be setting up three tents, you know. It's crazy up there. It's still crazy up there. But I just kept, I noticed some of these things were coming back, so I just kept pushing them down and pushing them down and drinking as much as I could. And I ended up getting fired from this job. Because they found out that I was stealing from them. I ended up breaking up with this really nice guy because he was too nice. That was my issue with him. Because, you know what, I wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink, and I didn't want anybody standing in my way, anybody or anything. So basically from that point, I was essentially unemployable. I graduated from college. Which was amazing, an amazing feat in itself because I was pretty screwed up. And I decided I wanted to get a job in my field, so I started applying for jobs, and I got one. And I lasted there 9 months. That's pretty good for someone like me. But I was showing up late or not showing up. When I was showing up late, I was incredibly drunk. I reeked of booze. I'm in the environmental field, so I'd show up at construction sites sometimes. And there was this one in particular, very important job that my boss put me on because he trusted me. And I would show up there 3 times, just gone. And that's the times I did show up. There were many times I did not show up. And he gave me another chance even after that to redeem myself, and I lasted about 2 weeks, and I just couldn't do it. I had to drink. You know, I have this mental obsession, and I have this allergy, and I always had the best of intentions. I'd say, okay, I'm going to go out tonight, and I'm going to have 2 or 3, and I'd close the bar every single time. You know, and so I lost this job. And I was unemployable from that point until 2 years into my sobriety. So it's about 5 years. And I mean, I'm young. You know, I got sober at 26, so it's pretty sad how quickly this thing, you know, sunk into me. So I'm miserable at this point. I'm feeling incredibly worthless because the high of getting that degree lasted me about a week. And so I just did exactly what I wanted to do, which was drink all the time. That is all I did. From morning to night, I started drinking alone. because every time I'd find a group of people to drink with, they would get sick of me quickly. And I would have to move on to the next group of people. And it was just this vicious cycle for me because no one wanted to be around me when I was drinking. I was mean. So I ended up in sordid places, did things I never thought I'd do, and things happened in my life that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. And when I'm trying to think, this is the part where it gets confusing for me. So after I graduated from college, I was hanging out with the same person I ran with for my entire childhood, and we were getting something out in a not-so-good area, and I got really angry for some reason, and I was driving extremely fast in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, and I remember I just flipped my car 3 times, and it rolled. And I had her in the car with me, and I thought in my drunken delusion that I could get out of this. I thought that I could roll my car over and drive away. So when the cops came, that's what they saw me doing. They saw me trying to physically lift my car to no avail. And they gave me a sobriety, you know, field test and all that stuff, and I failed miserably. And I didn't know that where I got in the accident was half a mile from the police station. So that's, you know, that's awesome. So it only took them 3 minutes to get there. So they took me in. I was mean to them. I was screaming at them. You know, I was cursing at them. And they still didn't keep me in a holding cell overnight. They let me go. My parents came and got me. And my parents didn't speak to me in that car. I was still living at home because I was, you know, awesome. And they were silent. It was like silent scorn. And that was worse for me. I mean, I'd rather them scream at me than not say anything. And they just said, I asked them why they weren't talking to me, and they said, we have nothing left to say to you. And I was just like, all right, well, this isn't good, you know? The only two people I have that are advocates for me in my life don't want to talk to me. And so I found out somewhere, well, my parents found out more than I did, that I had a major concussion from that accident. So they took me to the hospital, and I woke up in the morning on a stretcher with them looking at me and still not saying anything. And it was just the most painful thing in the world. And I resolved at that moment. I said, I'm not going to drink again. Like, you know, and that was, I had the best, absolute best of intentions. I really didn't want to drink. But I lasted about a week. I couldn't do that. I just, it was too painful. I had to drink. And I tried all those methods of control the Big Book talks about. You know, I tried drinking only at certain times of the day. I tried drinking only beer. I tried drinking only liquor. You know, I can't even think of them, but I tried pretty much everything. When I read that excerpt out of the Big Book, I'm like, I tried all of that. And none of it worked because I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I believe that in my heart. And the way that I think, it's evident in the way that I think, the way my mind works, it was evident then when I was drinking, and it's still evident. I have to do a lot of work, you know, with the guide of my understanding and my sponsor to curtail these things, because left to my own devices, I'm a wreck. So I got that second DUI, and things just kept spiraling out of control. As I said, I couldn't find employment. No one wanted to hire me because I got fired from my last two jobs. And most employers ask you, you know, even if I don't put it on that application, most of them ask you, like, why haven't you worked in 2 years? Like, What have you been doing? I'm drinking. But, so, as I said earlier, you know, I ended up in sordid places and things like that. I was absolutely miserable. I reached the point where I didn't want to live anymore. It was a pretty morbid time in my life. I just would wake up every day wanting to die. And I would be upset because the night before I'd tried to die, you know, by combining whatever cocktail I could. And I'd wake up and be like, okay, I have to do this all over again. Like, this is my existence. I was existing. You know, it was a horrible, wasn't even a life. It was just a horrible existence. And, you know, a couple years go by and I'm still doing my thing and I decide to go out with a friend of mine. And I took a whole, this night in particular, I took a whole bottle of a particular type of benzo because I just didn't want to be here anymore. And I was drinking and doing other things on top of that. And what actually ended up happening was nothing in terms of my health. I left this bar that a friend of mine was bartending at. Because me and this girl that I, you know, had been running with, we got in an argument over a man, of course. So I just left. You can have him. And I got in my car. I got kicked out, actually. The bouncer kicked me out because I was loud and mean and annoying. So I went to my car, started my car, started to leave. I hit the bouncer with my car. He had come out to tell me that he called me a cab because he didn't think that I was fit to drive. And thankfully I wasn't going fast. Thankfully he survived. But all I know is I don't remember the sequence of events that night. First of all, I thought I was a superhero. Second of all, I mean, I was incredibly delusional. Second of all, I don't remember any of it because I was a blackout drinker. Blackout right from the beginning, you know, as I explained earlier, the second time I drank. And it was pretty much every time I drank. So I was in a blackout. The only recollection of the evening that I have is from a police report. And apparently it took quite a few officers to get me to the ground. Apparently I broke out of the restraints. I was very violent. I sustained some injuries because I was fighting them, and so they had to fight back. I was looking pretty bad physically, pretty beaten up. And they were taking me to the barracks, and I asked if I could go to the hospital because I was bleeding. And they took me to the hospital, and I saw the guy that I hit. And the whole time to the hospital, this is probably important to mention, the whole time on the way to the hospital, the police officer's telling me, you hit someone. And because I hadn't realized that I hit this person. You hit someone. I'm like, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. You really did. You hit someone with your car. And so when I get to the hospital, I see this guy that I hit. He's going by on a stretcher. And he was a pleasant dude. He waved to me as he was going by on the stretcher. And, yeah, so, I mean, thankfully he was good. I broke his leg, but he was okay. But as a result of that, so I'm sitting in the hospital. Guess what I'm thinking about? Myself. I'm not thinking about the injuries I inflicted upon this guy. I'm not thinking about whether or not this guy that I hit is okay. I'm thinking about what's going to happen to me. Like, what's going to become of me? How long am I going to be in prison? You know, are they going to lock me up somewhere and throw away the key? Because I thought myself, my ego is a weird thing. I was beneath everyone, but at the same time, I thought myself above everyone. I was this very highly intelligent person who was smarter than all of you, who had the utmost potential to do anything, and that's absolutely not true at all, but that's what I thought, you know? But I was also the scum of the earth at the same time. I thought I was such a loser. So, I get out of the hospital. My parents say, we're done with you. You can't live here anymore. You are, like, literally like a tornado whipping through our lives. Your brother hates you. You know, I mean, I was horrible to all of them. And I did things in their house that people, you know, their kids shouldn't do in their parents' house. And they said, there is one thing. If you get sober, you can live here. But we have to see that you're trying, you know, something different, basically. Because my mom had this therapist who's also an Al-Anon, so that's how that came about. So the other stipulation was that I go to this therapist. And I had been going to that therapist for a while, but and she had told me I was an alcoholic 2 years prior to this, and I told her basically, F you. Which she was right. But so in that moment, after spending the night in the holding cell, because I did that night, I was bleeding. It was very cliche. I was bleeding. I was crying. I was laying on the concrete floor in a fetal position, and I said a foxhole prayer. And I had always been agnostic. I wouldn't say I'm atheist, but I've always been agnostic. But I, because I always thought, if there is a God, why is my life so horrible? You know, and I always set the ball rolling on everything. God was always there, but I didn't know that at the time. You know, so I'm laying in that holding cell. I say that foxhole prayer, and the first thing I think of is there's this older British gentleman that I worked with at the Outfitters that I worked at during college. And he had gotten sober a year before me, and every month he would call me and tell me that when I'm ready, he was saving me a seat. And I had no idea what he was talking about, and I would just say, okay, Robin, you know, whatever, dude. He became a really close family friend, before both of us got sober, but, he's the first thing I thought of, and I was like, I have to call him. And so when I got out and I was sitting at my parents' living room, you know, in shambles, I called him and he asked me what I was doing. And I said, nothing. I have no friends and my family can't stand me. He's like, well, why don't we go to a meeting? And I was like, I guess. Like, I'm out of answers at this point. I'm feeling pretty hopeless, very hopeless and miserable. And horribly ashamed of myself. So he came and got me that night. We went to a speaker meeting in Baltimore, and I kept going to meetings with him. As I said earlier, I was very angry, and part of that was I hated women, as many women do when they first get here. But I was so seething that it took about 3 months for me to let a woman talk to me. Every time they came up to me at a meeting, I would hiss at them, basically. My first home group placed bets on how long it would take me to go back out. So that being said, I wish I could say I stayed sober from that point. But I told Robin, there was a reason I told you all that. I told him that I would not work the steps unless he did them with me. Because my distrust of women was huge. There was no reason for it. It just was there. So he started taking me through the steps. And it was good. It was very helpful. But there were lady things that he didn't feel comfortable with. And so he would take them to this lady who was a very strong AA. And she would pretty much give him advice on how to direct me and what to suggest to me. And he didn't feel comfortable with it. He told me that from the start. He said, when you find a woman that you can trust, you know, that'll be good. But, yes, I will help you. So about 2 weeks, 3 weeks in, we went on a snowboarding trip. I got sober in February, the first little part of time that I was sober. And we went on a ski snowboarding trip, and I broke some ribs doing things on a snowboard I shouldn't have been doing. And so I had to go to the hospital, and they gave me some things that I like, and I abused them. And I was, like, so attached. I remember in really early sobriety, I was, like, really attached to my sobriety date, and I was so upset and fearful about going to my home group and saying, you know, I've been using drugs. And I told one of, like, the men with 20-some years, and he was like, seriously? He was like, it's not a big deal. Just go change your sobriety date. I was like, okay. So I did. It wasn't a big deal because everything is a much bigger deal in my head. But I was sober from that point on. That was June 4th, 09. And my friend Robin ended up moving back to Great Britain with his wife and daughter because he got a job over there. So I asked this lady that he'd been taking all of my lady things to sponsor me. And she already knew a great deal about me. So worked with her for a while. And, you know, in the middle of all of that, I had to go to court to face what I had done. And they sentenced me to 3 years in prison. And I ended up, usually what they do is they take you to a county jail first and then they put you on the road to prison after you've been staying there for a little while. So that's what we thought was going to happen. It was a serious amount of charges. It was my third DUI. In Maryland, where I'm from, third DUI does not mean felony. I know it. I've heard it does in Virginia. It does not mean that there. So thankfully, I am not a felon. But I was facing a plethora of different charges, including assault on a police officer. These were pretty serious things. And it was starting to sink into me that this was serious, you know. And I remember going to court, and who was there? People from AA, my parents. And they took me to jail right from court. I didn't get, like, a little break. They were just like, all right. I got shackled up, and they took me. And jail was horrible. I had about 2 months sober at that point. I didn't really have a solution. Alcohol, I still viewed alcohol as my solution, although at the end of my drinking, I will say probably about the last year or so, my mind started racing again. The alcohol was getting me physically intoxicated, but not mentally drunk anymore. And that was the worst feeling in the world. That, I think that's why I wanted to die. But so I go to jail, and people from AA visit me. My sponsor visits me every week. She brings a girl with her every week to visit me. My parents visited me every week. And lo and behold, my attorney comes to me one day. He says, I can get you out of here. You know, do you want to hear what I have to say? I'm like, what kind of question is that? Tell me what you're proposing. And he was like, there's a state-run halfway house facility. If you go there, you know, that's part of your sentence. We can get you out of here in the next month or so. So I did that. It was a difficult experience because pretty much everyone at that facility was still using or drinking. There were two people that were not, three people including myself, and we kind of stuck together. Because I was serious at this point. I didn't want to live that way anymore. I knew that I would probably die, and I saw hope when I came in here. At first, as I said, I was very angry. People were smiling at me, and I wanted to punch you in the face. That's really how I felt. And then I slowly started to say, all right, these people have something that I'm missing, and I want that. And I started fellowshipping a lot with people in AA in early sobriety, and we went up to Massachusetts for, you know, little ACTS recovery conferences, and we went up to Vermont for them, and, you know, just fellowship with people from different states. And, you know, this is, of course, after I got out of jail, but, I mean, it was a cool experience. It was extremely uncomfortable. I will say that. I remember all the feelings of uncomfortability because I had been so maladjusted to life for so long, and I didn't know how to relate to other people. I still have trouble with that. I'm not good with relationships with people. It's a very hard thing for someone like me. But anyway, I digress. I worked with this sponsor for a while. She ended up getting diagnosed with breast cancer. And she was going through a lot of stuff. So I got a different sponsor. Her and I remained friends. but I still, at this point in my recovery, was very selfish and needed a lot of attention. And so I picked this woman who was tough. And she really helped me a lot with the emotional stuff. We did, like, a traditions inventory. Because it's two years sober, I felt like dying again. I was acting out on a lot of old behaviors, well, behaviors that are familiar to me, that I hadn't changed. Because I didn't know this at the time, but the road for me was narrowing. I was getting less and less tolerant about these things that I had been doing for so long. I was suffering spiritually because of it in a really bad way. I was taking some of the suggestions that my sponsor was giving me, but I wasn't taking all of them. So when I switched to this other sponsor, you know, some of those things were still lingering, but, you know, I was really trying to surrender these things to, you know, God. I call my higher power God. And what ended up happening is, you know, I started surrendering these things. The walls started coming down because, I mean, not only did I have walls, I had a roof with these walls. I mean, it was very hard to penetrate. And the way that I always coped with my fear, and the only way I knew to cope with my fear was to wear the mask of anger, because I was always so full of fear. And I know that now. I didn't know that at the time, but when I started getting rid of these things, well, when I surrendered these things to God and they started to kind of dwindle and lessen, I got a job in my field after 5 years. The government hired me, which is just crazy. That should tell you something right there. But I did a good job because it turns out that when I'm sober, I work really hard. And I'm a good employee, and I showed up every day for work. I did my job. You know, I started doing service work in AA. I started going to treatment centers and jails and speaking and things like that. I was just trying to bring these principles into other areas of my life because I didn't understand in early sobriety that I wasn't just supposed to act with good conduct in a meeting. You know, I thought I could just run around rampant like I had been when I was drinking. And it's not good. Then I worked for the government for 2 years, and I ended up getting a phone call one day about a job in Richmond. And I was like, all right, I've always tried to get out of Baltimore. And every time I've had a really good opportunity, because I had so much potential, I crapped all over it because my drinking had to come first, or I got in some sort of legal trouble. That was always the case. So when this opportunity came, I was like, yeah, I think it's time, because I've cleaned a lot of this stuff up. I'm not running from anything. You know, I just want to change. And it turned out to be awesome. I moved to Richmond. I knew one person down there named Sammy, because she had come up to my, you know, where I lived and spoken, and I knew women up there where I'm from that she sponsors. So I was like, okay. I got linked up with her when I moved to Richmond. She hooked me up with a bunch of other people. I went to her home group. I knew that I had to do all these things because I know myself, and I knew that if I just moved down there and didn't do anything, I would wallow in my self-pity because I'm really quick to go to that. Like, poor me, I have no friends, no one likes me, I'm not getting invited anywhere, all that stuff. So she really plugged me in. She helped me out a lot when I moved down there. I had about 3 years sober at the time, and I joined a home group. I joined her home group because that's the one meeting I felt at home at. And so got a service position there. Started getting involved in district service work, started really sponsoring women. You know, it just started happening. Every time I'd pretty much speak, I'd get a sponsee, and it was just like, It was great. I mean, do I really want to go to someone's aid when they call me? No, it's inconvenient. But every time I do it, the effects of it are so great and so profound. I feel so good about everything when I help somebody else, when I get out of myself. And for me, like, that's the only thing that's ever worked. You know, whether it be in within AA or not, even if it's at work, if I, you know, I could be thinking, you know, angry thoughts at work, and then I just go, you know, stick my hand out to go help someone, and I feel better. But I know in AA that that's not the only reason we do it. You know, we have to pass this message on to others, and it's just crazy. You know, in early sobriety, I couldn't see how far I'd come, but I see it now, because I look back and I'm like a completely different person, you know, and I have a life today. You know, I have a full-time job, and I do a great job at my job, and, you know, I've got a host of friends, and I'm happy today. I'm not always happy every day. You know, life happens. Things aren't all unicorns and rainbows for me. There are some very challenging things that go on. I'm dealing with a lot of emotional things right now. Because I had never dealt with emotions in the past, and so a lot of that stuff just keeps coming up. There's a guy named Tom B. that spoke about it, emotional sobriety. It's tough. It's really tough to surrender to, but I'm doing the best that I can on a daily basis. And I just can't believe the life AA has given me. I never thought that I'd be standing in a circle at the end of a, you know, congregation of alcoholics, holding hands with them and praying. I mean, that was just, when I came in here and I saw that, I was like, what is going on? You know, like, I am not drinking that Kool-Aid. And I did. I drank it. This is just, you know, when I rely on God, I was reading something yesterday and it said, God either is or he isn't. He is either everything or he's nothing. And that's absolutely true for me, because when I, to this day, when I run my own life, or when I try to run my own life, unmanageability happens almost immediately. And things start to crumble around me. And I start to feel that pain that we get. And that's what motivates me to do something different. And I know today that it doesn't have to be that way. I can act before that happens. But unfortunately, more often than not, I have to be in pain before I'm willing to do something. The road keeps narrowing for me. The longer I stay sober, I am able to tolerate less and less about myself that I find deplorable, or not even deplorable, just, you know, character defects that weren't glaring at first, but now they are, because the really big ones when I first got sober are no longer there. It's not an easy way to live for someone like me, because my natural state is to go drink, but it's far better than anything I could have ever imagined. So I think I'm about done, and I really appreciate you asking me to come out here and speak. I hope somebody got something out of it. Anyway, thank you.